just bossed Darius around a bit. Let me see what else I can think of you to do. really? Good. Good to know. Well, first of all, again, thank you for being here, and I want to just thank everybody that's contributed so far. Beautiful Lonnie, and how wonderful that you got the flowers from beautiful Jana, who did a beautiful meditation. You may notice that there is another face in the choir sitting next to Nipun. It is actually the woman who sang the song that Jana played. Her name is Sanatam Kaur, and she is a Sikh singer, so we have another representative of one of the world great religions, a Sikh woman, up on the stage now. And it's nice that she's sitting next to Nipun, because he is actually married to a Sikh woman. So there you go. And I didn't want to leave out Vicky, because Vicky did a fantastic job as well. Vicky, I'm talking about you, girl. Okay. And Kenny doing sound, and Norm videoing, and Dave here for support, and Brock doing all number of things, and Chris's faithful place at the piano, and Darius singing so beautifully, and Annette in the office, and Jennifer, bless Jennifer's heart, jumping in and doing this video. Just flying by the seat of her pants, but getting it down pat now. So I think I got everybody, didn't I? I think so. Oh, Hugh at home. Hugh. Beautiful reading, fantastic reading, wonderful. Yeah, I got Brock. Yeah, I got everybody. Yeah, okay, we're good to go. Allow me to begin. Okay, so some of you may have heard a little touch of a rumor that churches might be reopening next week. I know that I got some emails about that, and people were wondering what our plan is. Now, we did actually have a meeting a little over a week ago about what we were going to do. And I know that people are eager to open, but I'll tell you what our plan is as of now, is to listen to what the governor has to say tomorrow, and then apply the rules of science and social distancing and see what we can do. We'll open as soon as we possibly can. It will be different than it was before. I have all kinds of information from our insurance company, which I'm really hoping to read tonight. Hoping is maybe not the right word, but I'm not even looking forward to reading it, but I'm going to read it. And I also have a little book about how to open a church during a quarantine. So that sounds like another good read. If any of you are interested, I'd be happy to send you the link. So we're going to do it safely, and we're going to do it carefully. But I know that many of us are eager to see each other, so we will do it as soon as we possibly can, safely, as soon as we safely can. You know, and I think that there are probably many of us that are excited about reopening. I know that I've spoken to many people over the last couple of months that have been really struggling with the separation and the quarantine and the isolation, and people that are struggling financially because of businesses that have shut down. So there is this eagerness to reopen. But the other thing that I'm hearing, and I'm feeling it myself a little bit, is that I'm wondering if part of us might miss the quarantine, that might miss the pandemic and the implications that it has for us of moving at a slower pace and getting to stay home more and reprioritizing. So when I was looking around for a talk title this morning, what came to me was, I want to stay sheltered in Rumi's field. And then I stamped my foot. I want to stay sheltered in Rumi's field. Because in some ways, this quarantine has felt like a retreat in this center, what we might call Rumi's field. And I'll be talking about what that means in just a little bit. But really, you know, I think that it's possible to go back to a life that is full of some of the stuff that we left behind, some of the stuff that we're missing, but that we can also retain some of the consciousness of what it has been like to be isolated and at home more and moving at a slower pace. So this talk this morning, Let's Stay Sheltered in Rumi's Field, is about knowing that wherever we are, Rumi's Field will go with us, because it's not a literal place. It is a consciousness that will travel with us. So let me talk a little bit about what Rumi's Field is. And before I do, this thing is bugging me. So this is coming off. Yeah, I hear you. Everybody's whistling. That is the only thing I am taking off, okay, as far as I know, unless my false eyelashes start falling off. That's a whole other sermon. But anyway, Rumi's Field. I know that we have people viewing this that are not really familiar with our church, with our center, but we talk about Rumi's Field a lot. In fact, Rumi is up there. You can hardly see him. You can just see the tip of his head next to Wayne Dyer and Rupert Spira behind the Dalai Lama. Rumi is a poet. Yeah, don't bother, Jen. Rumi is a poet that his poetry is representative of mystical Islam. He's a Sufi poet, and he started the Whirling Dervishes. So he is certainly one of the ecstatic poets that talks a lot about the love of the beloved. He refers to God often as the beloved. In the book that we're featuring this month, the book by Mirabai Starr called Wild Mercy, she talks about Rumi as being a female soul in a male's body because he is so divinely feminine in some ways in his approach to theology and to understanding the relationship with the beloved. So he wrote this poem that we quote a lot, and it's out beyond ideas of wrongdoing and right doing, there is a field. I'll meet you there. When the soul lies down in that grass, the world is too full to talk about. I'm going to say it one more time. Out beyond ideas of wrongdoing and right doing, there is a field. I'll meet you there. When the soul lies down in that grass, the world is too full to talk about. And that's a portion of the poem, but to me that's the best part, out beyond ideas of wrongdoing and right doing. So, you know, it reminds me a little bit of what the Christian tradition says about the kingdom of heaven. You know, when Jesus was bopping around, and you know, we've got Jesus there too. I'm glad that the flat choir is having such a presence in this center today. We've got Jesus back there too, and when Jesus was doing his thing, he talked a lot about the kingdom of heaven. He would say things like, the kingdom of heaven is at hand. And I'm sure that the people that he was talking to, many of them did not recognize that he might be not speaking literally, but metaphorically. They'd be like, the kingdom of heaven is hand. Where is it? Where is it? Is it up there? Is it down there? Where is it? No, not down there. You know, he'd be wondering. That was more the kingdom of heaven is within, right? People would be wondering, what is he talking about? Everything, life is just like it was. Nothing is fixed. Nothing's better. And yet he's saying the kingdom of heaven is at hand, which is the same thing as saying the kingdom of heaven is here and now. So I think that what Jesus and what Rumi both were talking about, Rumi's field and the kingdom of heaven being at hand and the kingdom of heaven being within, I think that they were talking about states of consciousness. And so that's what I'm asking us to carry into this next phase of the pandemic, the states of consciousness that emulate Rumi's field or the kingdom of heaven. And we have many ideas about what that might be. Certainly it's compassion and as I've said before, slowing down and breathing and recognizing what's important. But today in this message, I'm going to talk about three spiritual values that I think are important in Rumi's field and sometimes overlooked. They are paradox, process, and the priceless. So I'm going to start with paradox. There is an illusion about what Rumi's field is supposed to be. People think that when we are in Rumi's field, life is beautiful, and there are daisies and butterflies, and the rain falls at just the precise time, and if there are other people there, we actually like them, and and we tell each other our deepest secrets, and everybody's a really good listener, and they respect us, and then we braid each other's hair, and then we hold hands, and we skip down a garden path, merrily singing something saintly. It sounds nice, but I think that Rumi's field is actually something different. Rumi's field looks an awful lot like the planet Earth, with the, what we would call the good, the bad, the ugly, the in-between, all of that fully functioning to get us to wake up to the beauty beyond appearances. In her book, Mirabai Star writes about the Buddhist Bodhisattva Kuan Yin, who is an embodiment of feminine compassion. And she talks about her life. This is in Wild Mercy by Mirabai Star. She talks about the life of Kuan Yin. And when she was born, her name wasn't Kuan Yin, but I can't remember what it was right now, so I'll just call her Kuan Yin. When she was born into a family that really wanted a boy. And so they weren't very nice to her. They were quite mean to her, and they made her do all of these horrible chores that nobody else wanted to do. But Kuan Yin was so gracious and so forgiving and so lovely that she enlisted the little forest creatures to help her. They said that the mouse threaded the needle that she was using to sew, and the deer helped her chop her wood, and I don't know what the skunk did, but he did something. So she was so gracious that their restrictions on her didn't have any impact whatsoever, even though they were being cruel and unkind to her. When it came time for her to marry, her father said that she had to marry because that was part of the tradition, and Kuan Yin said, "No, I can't marry. I want to devote my life to the beloved, to service, to compassion. I want to be part of a monastery." And so her father searched around for the meanest monastery he could find. You know, think about, like, this was not The Sound of Music, okay? This was more like the Blues Brothers. And we'd see that movie where the nun has the ruler and she's whacking people. It's a different kind of nun, I think, in Kuan Yin's case. But she went to, like, the most awful monastery that the father could find. And when she was there, he insisted that they make her do the quote-unquote worst tasks, which for them was sitting with the sick and the dying. So she had to address all kinds of bodily issues, fluids, people in great emotional pain, sitting and listening to people, holding people as they died, and they thought that perhaps she couldn't take it, but she loved the work. She loved it, and she poured her whole heart and her soul and her forgiveness into that. Well, that really made her father mad. Because when he came to the monastery and found that she was thriving with this plan that he had for her to be diminished somehow, and she was thriving in spite of it, he said, "Okay, that's it. We're going to execute you." Yeah. And so we had a reaction from the crowd, the six of you. And so they brought Kuan Yin to the executioner's block, and as he was raising his axe to chop off her head, she looked up at him and she said, "I forgive you." And it said that the axe shattered into a million pieces and the executioner was transformed on the spot. And Kuan Yin vaporized into another being, where she went to an island and she spent the rest of her days in this body praying for compassion and praying for the soul of the world until she passed away and became the Bodhisattva of compassion in the Buddhist faith. She forgave her executioner as he was about to execute her. And this is a bit unlike some of the things that perhaps you and I encounter in our day-to-day business. You know, how does this work? How does this work? Rumi's field isn't perfect. Rumi's field isn't all daisies and butterflies and flowers and braiding each other's hair. Rumi's field is rough. Rumi's field has executioners and people that are unkind to us. How does this work? How do we stay in Rumi's field when all of this is going on? Is it that we're doing something wrong? Did we do something in our consciousness to create that? Perhaps, but perhaps not. Perhaps what we're doing in our consciousness is calling forth a higher level of trust and a higher level of spiritual awakening to become more of who we were intended to be. I have to say that, you know, as a minister, I encounter people in conflict all the time, and I do a lot of talking around this topic with them. But because of confidentiality, I can't share any stories about anybody. But I can share a story about my personal life. So if you're wondering if this story is about you, if I've spoken to you about conflict lately, trust me, it is not. unless you're my friend who lives in New York, and then it's totally about you. So anyway, I was on the phone with her recently and just feeling, you know, one of the things about this conversation is it made me so grateful for this teaching, because we know something in this teaching. We know something a little bit different. Because she was telling me about an argument that she had had with another friend, and we had talked about this friend before, and this person does have a tendency to be a little demanding, a little difficult sometimes, but my friend was very invested in being hurt and very invested in making this person wrong. Because if we have to be right, then we're automatically making somebody else wrong. And yet, in Rumi's field, it says that there's a space beyond wrongdoing and rightdoing. But how do we get there? How do we get there? And this person, I don't think she could really hear what I was saying, so I told her about an example in my own life, which is also somewhat confidential, but I can say it cryptically, of somebody that hurt my feelings. Again, not somebody here in the church. Well, it was Darius. No, I'm kidding. I'm kidding. Somebody who hurt my feelings, and I felt ashamed and embarrassed and humiliated, and I was so angry with this person, and I did forgiveness work, but still, it wasn't right. And then ultimately, with more meditation and more spiritual practice and more recognizing that, wait, this is for me, this is not against me, I recognized that there was something in me that got triggered, and I got to look at that, and I got to look at that and heal that. And then I was so grateful for this person, to this person, that I thanked him. I thanked him for getting in my face and embarrassing me and shaming me. And that's the prize, that's the pearl of great price, that's the wonder. I was trying to convey this to my friend, that it's not about changing the other person. It is never about changing the other person. It's about seeing what is triggered in us and seeing that there's a better way, that beyond their idea of what is wrong and what is right, that there is a third way, and the third way so often involves going within and seeing, oh my goodness, there's something beautiful that wants to emerge through this. How do I get to that place? Where can I sacrifice where my ego is holding on? What can I let go of? Spirit, beloved, change me into someone that understands this and can emerge like Kuan Yin, ready to forgive even my executioner. Again, so often when we're embroiled in an argument, we are trying to make the other person wrong so that we can feel right. And I love that Ernest Holmes says, you know, your judgment judges you. And really, our need to be right, or our need to make others wrong, makes us wrong at the same time. I'm sorry. I'm sure that was painful for many of us to hear, but it's just the truth. There is such power in the willingness to move into Rumi's field and just breathe and love ourselves enough to take responsibility for the part that we're playing in any type of altercation. That is using the third force that we talk a lot about here, that there is a yes, that there is a no, and that there is something that is greater than yes or no. We move into that place where we are receptive to the third force, and then miracles can happen. You know, one of this miracle of this experience that I had with a friend that embarrassed me and shamed me, I felt that he shamed me, he was really just trying to do what he needed to do. One of the miracles happened again as I was writing this talk, as I was preparing this talk and thinking about, wow, you know, it used to be that I could only be inspired by inspiring things, like Mozart, or beautiful art, or nature. And now, wow, look how inspired you are, Bonnie, at something that was painful and humiliating. That changed your life. That prepared you for what's going on now. That was amazing. And so I offer all of that to you as well. I really hope something painful happens to you. And that you can be inspired by it, inspired beyond belief by just the willingness to just say, okay, 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 I'm willing to learn from this, I'm willing to learn from this, I'm willing to see how this can bring me deeper. Yes, it's not all about me. Yes, it's not all about them. It is about the third force that is seeking to emerge here in this challenging situation. I am going to forgive my executioner, and I am going to rise to the occasion to be that embodiment of paradox and compassion. Rumi's field is a paradox. Another aspect of Rumi's field is that it is a process. How many of us, when we became ministers or practitioners, or when we joined a church, or when we started meditating, said, okay, this is going to fix it. I am going to meditate, and then I will have arrived. Anybody? Right. How many of us have cleaned our house and said, the house is clean now, I am complete? How many of us have weeded our gardens and said, the garden is weeded, thank God I don't have to do that anymore? Rumi's field is just like all of that stuff, because you know that none of that stuff is true, right? It is always a process. It is a process that spirals and expands, and that's part of what is beautiful about it. You know, I use this metaphor a lot, but it continues to inform me in I hope, deeper and deeper ways. And that's the idea that the way that our bodies work, there is an exchange of positive and negative ions in our bodies all the time. I think about it a lot with nerve cells or cardiac muscle, but I'm up here speaking, waving my arms, breathing, all of that stuff, because there is an exchange in the nerve cells of positive and negative ions. And the positive and the negative ions just go. They just cross over the cell membrane and they just go. The positive ions do not stand there, and if I could touch something, I would, but I'm not supposed to touch anything, and grip onto something and say, no, 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 I'm not going over the negative side. I can't go. Don't, you can't make me. I'm not going over there, right? They just go back and forth, and that is life. Life is a constant exchange of what we might call positive and negative. There's no judgment on positive and negative ions. They're just ions, and life is just life. And you might say, well, Reverend Bonnie, I'm not just an ion, I have a brain. True. But the truth is that we are our ions. Ions are little tiny charged particles that are part of everybody's physiology, that are part of the whole system of the world. So in the Vedantic tradition, we step back and we say, I am not this, I am not that, I am not my body, I am not my thoughts, I am not my emotions. In the tantric tradition, we say, I am everything that is, and both are true. So you're not your ions, you're not your cells, you're not your molecules, but you also are. And there's always this positive and negative exchange going on in your body, so why shouldn't there be a positive and negative exchange going on in life? I've been working every week to bring in a Ventura Center for Spiritual Living hero into the service, somebody that I want to talk about that others may not know, some of the good work that they're doing. And this is an example of how these positive and negative courses just can shape all kinds of beauty. And this is a really ordinary and simple example, and I picked it for that reason. Earlier this week, I was minding my own business. I was on Facebook, and I received a message from Deborah Callie, who sent me a picture that was on Facebook of somebody wearing a Be Kind t-shirt. We have Be Kind t-shirts in this center that we offer to people quite liberally. And she was wearing this Be Kind t-shirt, and she had a mask on and a cap, so it was a little hard to tell who she was, but I said to myself, and I said to Deborah, I think that's Jackie Hamer. And I copied her on it, and she said, yep, that was me. I wear that shirt every time I volunteer. Now, I don't know if Jackie's a member here. I don't think she is, because she also goes to Temple Beth Torah when she invites me over there frequently, and I just love Rabbi Lisa. She's one of my favorite ministers. She's a great person. But Jackie is devoted to the work of this church as well, and she's obviously devoted to service. And she was wearing a Be Kind t-shirt, which is emblematic of our center. But where did that Be Kind t-shirt come from? Well, it came from last year, when we brought 17 children who lived in the slums of India to the United States, and we brought them to Disneyland, and we had to have something where we could see them so they wouldn't all go over all over the place, and we could find them if we needed to. So there's the slums. There's the slums. Is that a negative or is that a positive? I don't know. There's Disneyland. Is that a negative or is that a positive? I don't know. There's the slums, and then there's how I met those children. Going to India and meeting Nimmo Patel, well, I met him before, but meeting Nimmo Patel and getting close to him in India, a positive, I think. And then I met Nimmo Patel through meeting Nipun Mehta, sitting right there next to Sanatam Kaur. And I think that's a positive too, but it wasn't at the beginning, because I met Nipun because I was trying to get Wayne Dyer, sitting in the back row where he belongs, by the way. Sorry. No, just because he wouldn't come and speak at our church. But it was a good thing, because we got Nipun, and I don't think I would have had an extended relationship, or we would have had an extended relationship with Wayne Dyer, who is deceased, by the way, may he rest in peace. But we had this extended friendship with Dipun that changed the trajectory of this church. So it seemed like a negative. Wayne Dyer won't come and speak at our church, dang it. And then Dipun Mehta comes, and he does speak, and he changes the whole consciousness of this church. Service space, his organization, all of us working together. It's not just him, it's all of us resonating with what he has to say. So that seems like a positive and a negative interacting. And then when you look back in Nipun's life, he comes from extreme poverty. His great-great-grandfather, I believe, lived in India, and they didn't have any money, but he still wanted to serve, and so he would take pinches of wheat and feed the anthills as he was going on his morning walk. And again, poverty, that seems like a negative, but wait, service within poverty, that seems like a positive. So the truth is that there is always this exchange of positive and negative in our bodies and in our life, but which is wrongdoing and which is right doing? Which is negative, which is positive? Which do we judge as negative and which do we judge as positive? It's both, it's contraction and expansion all the time. And if we're not like, you know, I mentioned how the ions were saying, don't make me go over to the negative side. If we just manage to go with the flow with it and understand that everything is a process, and if it's something challenging, this too shall pass. And if it's something that we love, also this too shall pass, and we don't need to cling to it. That also provides us with the spaciousness of Rumi's field. The last thing that I want to talk about is the idea of pricelessness, that Rumi's field is priceless. You know, I just did a brief seminar with some folks from Service Space, which is a global service organization, and we talked about this thing that we do here called priceless pricing and how we came up with the term. And certainly I think of priceless pricing as from many traditions, but I know it best through the Christian tradition, where they talk about how a merchant sold everything that he had to obtain the pearl of great price. And the pearl of great price is not a literal pearl, but it is something. And I'm constantly redefining what that is, but I think it's just that intangible spiritual connection to the one that we have always, the connection to the beloved, the connection to Rumi's field, the connection to the kingdom of heaven. And whatever that looks like, however that is manifested within us in a unique and sacred and special way. And so that's what Rumi's field is. It's priceless. And it's priceless not only because of the beauty in it, but it's also priceless because of the ugliness in it as well. You know, Kuan Yin's compassion stands out against the backdrop of cruelty, and that's what makes it more sacred. Darkness and light, same thing. Joy and sorrow, same thing. Love and loss are intertwined, and all of that is priceless. Without a hurt, the heart is hollow. And so this pandemic in its own way has been priceless to us. And one of the ways that I wanted to highlight how this pandemic has been priceless was to, again, ask another Facebook question, which I'm going to get to now. I think I have time. And I want to read the responses from the congregation, what they said about that. I asked the congregation, in the quarantine, what has been your most priceless discovery? And Susie discovered the depth of love in her life and the power of music to transform. Carolinda discovered the pricelessness of inner stillness. Chris, the joy of slowing down and living at a savoring pace. Love that word. Karen, she rediscovered her love and devotion from her dog, Sophie, and knows that she is now truly able to use the third force. Vicky, blessed with many new beginnings. Shelley has always felt blessed and abundant, but now being with her family sees that it has multiplied in magnificent ways. Dina, what is valuable shifts, but her center resides. There's less emphasis on accoutrement and more on being. Preto, stillness over and over and over again. Karen, she has discovered time for healing and releasing, and clarity about love is the only important thing. Bernie has discovered stillness and a slower pace to notice nature and the generosity of loving care that is shared and received. Our friend Randy, who lives in LA now, he just posted a picture of his dog. Dave, a new appreciation of radical acceptance. Janet has rediscovered the preciousness of her relationships and how we can still reach out and still be connected despite the distance. Mark quoted the Desiderata, I am a child of the universe, I have a right to be here. Brock said, friendship, really? Susan, embracing a slower pace. It's okay when it becomes frustrating. And she also embraces and has discovered kindness and supportive community, friends and strangers. Kathy recognizes that it's never too late to reach out despite the passage of time. She's been having all kinds of long conversations with friends from years ago. Jonna wrote how a phone call and Zoom and Peter Frank can brighten someone's day. Bill said that when he takes the agenda out of the equation, stress is no longer an issue, and he finds true freedom. Debbie and Lenine both found that when they focus more on spiritual practice, this leads to greater happiness. Nick discovered the possibilities of true change that can come in all shapes and sizes. Karen says that she's hearing the stories that she tells herself, and she's choosing to be open to something different if she doesn't like the story, and she is choosing to be open with love. Gia, she has discovered the quiet of her heart and mind. Kathy has discovered that she can both thrive while in isolation and yet deeply miss physical connection and know that God is in all of it, both the thriving and the missing. Kat has big gratitude for divine timing and guidance and landing in the most beautiful, wonderful area. Cindy has discovered the power of all of the good friends. Annie is discovering so much love and caring bestowed upon their offspring, her children, to, as she said, keep us little seniors safe and well. She says that's what her children call them, the little seniors. Bill, who is Annie's husband, said that his net worth has increased as his spouse has reduced her shopping trips. I believe Jonna jumped in on that one, too. Sarah says that she has learned so much about Jesus Christ from reading the Book of Mormon. And Kit has expressed gratitude for being alive, self-forgiveness in failings and in fears. And Jan has discovered strength in facing fear, guidance in finding abundance. Sue has discovered the power of wildlife and less pollution, family time, realizing how precious everyone and everything is, but she still misses hugs. And Michelle is becoming friends with her fear of technology, and she is learning Zoom. So as you can see, we have an amazing and beautiful congregation. And I know that reopening is coming soon, and we're going to do it in a way that supports all of us. But let's hold the intention that it's not only a safe reopening, that it is a magnificent opening that embraces all of Rumi's Field, and that Rumi's Field embraces us, and that the kingdom of heaven is within here and out there, and that we are just immersed in this beautiful spiritual power that we call love. We truly are a center of love where we aspire to be love, share love, and serve love. I'm going to close with a quote. Some of it's me, and some of it's Mirabai Starr. As we return, we carry the consciousness of Rumi's Field with us, paradox, process, and pricelessness. And we also know this. This is from Mirabai Starr. Falling in love with the divine, abiding in Rumi's Field, does not rescue us from the human condition. Our loved ones will betray us sometimes. Our dead will remain dead. It's keeping the heart open, even in hell, and that makes space for the beloved. It is the darkest nights of our souls when all we know is that we know nothing, that the presence of the sacred may quietly well up, mingling our pain and connecting us to a love that will never die. Let us connect to that love that will never die, the beloved within us, the beloved at hand, to Rumi's Field, to the kingdom of heaven. Let's do that now. Let us pray.